Welcome to the Casterbras podcast. My name is Christian Corley, and with me is James McLean. Hello, say hello, James.
Oh, if you just want my voice, my voice was better a couple of days ago, where it was literally an octave lower, which was just meant I could sing along to songs in the car with a deep, sexy voice. It was really cool.
Well, the old mixing desk, I could have just turned us both into sort of very low, sort of Barry White sort of voices, but I can't do that with this, unfortunately. It's the only regret I have of upgrading, really. So we're here to have a little bit of a chat, and it's probably going to evolve into a sort of a Doctor Who direction eventually. It better had, because I've named the podcast very specifically, which you will know by now, dear listener. But it was inspired by the news and the accompanying video of Wrexham City. Is it Wrexham City or Wrexham FC? Co-owner Ryan Reynolds, and Hugh Jackman. And the unveiling, unveiling is not the right word, is it? Revelation. Maybe it's unveiling. Maybe it is. Well, the revelation.
It was a bit unveiling, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a bit, I suppose. And also a bit revelatory as well, because, you know, Hugh Jackman said he's not going to play Wolverine again. That ship has sailed or something, he said. And he's back playing Wolverine in the MCU, which is really, really, I think it's really exciting. Not just that, I mean, Deadpool 3 is kind of exciting, but I've only watched all the Deadpool movies once. Actually, no, I've only watched Deadpool once. I haven't seen Deadpool 2 yet, because I don't have a reason for it. It just hasn't happened. But I've been saying for a long time, and James may recall me saying this more than once, that recasting Wolverine is very difficult because Hugh Jackman's portrayal is, I don't think I said definitive or so definitive or anything like that, but pretty much, I mean, they haven't recast him for the MCU, basically. They've brought in Deadpool and Wolverine from the, is this the Fox branch of Marvel?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, got to be careful. I still think they're going to recast. But
do you?
I think, yeah.
Are they going to recast Logan? That's the question.
I think they probably will. Well, this is something we can talk about, but yeah? I think, yeah.
Okay. Mm. Yeah. Well, just to think about that, dear listener, if you just put that into your head for a while, our angle of coming at this, I've created a brief list of other definitive performances, or what I consider to be definitive, some of them. So we can sort of go through this, and then we can sort of return back to the Wolverine thing, and then branch off into adventures in time and space. So I've got Christopher Lee as Dracula. I've got Harrison Ford as Han Solo. There's obviously been two people who played Han Solo, and the other guy was okay, but I don't think he was quite Han Solo. Christopher Reeves as Superman is, I don't think anyone can dispute that one. Connery as Bond is possibly disputable. It depends what your take on Bond is, though. Bond's very much a malleable character for the ages, a bit like the Doctor. And James may either strongly agree or strongly disagree, or you just might like partially agree and partially disagree. It's, you know, all options are open. All of the original series of Star Trek. Those are my definitives. There's probably many others out there. The Beatles, rather than the bootleg Beatles, for example. The post Paul is dead Paul McCartney, as opposed to the earlier Paul is dead. I'm joking now. But yeah, the fact is, I feel that there are definitive people characterizations. James, what do you think? Am I right in these? Am I swerving?
I think it's nice that we've gone with, because we could have obviously gone with the old classic Hartnell quote of, you know, the original, I might, or was
oh yes, yes.
Hartnell quote, isn't it? The original, you might say.
Yeah.
And I think there is a distinction, because you can be the definitive without being the original. You know, some people would say Christian Bale is the definitive Batman, while others will say, yeah, but, you know, the original Batman, well, we could go back to the 40s, but, you know, a lot of people obviously consider Adam West to be the original mainstream Batman anyway.
So certainly I think enough to spin off a comic series from the entire era.
Well, that's not hard these days, but
true, but yeah. It was a little bit unusual at the time, but now you point it out that these days, no, it's not that different, no.
But yeah, no, I think it's always an interesting question. I think often what is considered culturally the original often tends to be the definitive, but again, you know, this isn't always the case. And that's one of the things with anything that has multiple, I suppose, adaptions, is that, you know, you really got to be looking for what is considered to be, well, it's a difficult one because, yeah, a lot of people will say with adaption, you shouldn't be looking for what is, you know, the quintessential. You should just be considering each adaption for what they are. But ultimately, society does tend to give origin points, even if they're not accurate. Like, you know, Snow White, people will often think, if you say Snow White, they'll think of the Disney film rather than the fairy tale. That will be their origin point, even though it's not the origin point. And the same with Batman, you know,
Winnie the
Batman,
Pooh.
we don't. Winnie the Pooh, absolutely. So it's an interesting question of what is definitive in, and as you say, it's obviously it's a cultural interpretation which we all have.
Well, you know what? I've inadvertently expanded our range here because I mentioned the Beatles, didn't I? And of course, John Paul, George, and Ringo aren't the original Beatles.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then there's Deep Purple as well, another band that had a lead singer before its famous lead singer of Ian Gillan, which I
Yeah,
only discovered this a few
absolutely.
weeks ago. So yeah, it's wow. Yeah, this is oh crikey, we've unscrewed a Pandora's box of worms here.
Well, yeah, we wandered into adaptation theory and adaptation theory and all those sort of things.
Okay, I didn't
Yeah,
know
I
that was a
think.
thing, but go on.
Oh yes, it's a big field. I think it's but I think it is interesting. Like, you know, what do we consider to be definitive, and does that ever change? And obviously, it does. Obviously, I've got. Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, you could say, like, you know, for years everyone said Sean, as you say, Sean Connery is a definitive Bond, and I think for a generation he is, but for another generation, you know, he's not. And I think, you know, that is the issue, isn't it? I mean, so many people will say Tom Baker is the definitive Doctor, while others will obviously, a lot of younger people will say David Tennant, or, you know, fringe groups like me might say Sylvester McCoy, you know. But yeah, you're right. I think it's always interesting to see what is. I think the question what one is asking is how much of a character is brought by the actor to what is on the page, how much of it becomes so much a sort of embodiment of the actor. And I think Han Solo is an interesting one because I think Han Solo is actually quite, and I think Ford as well. Between the characters it's written and the characters it's played, and this is probably Ford's fault more than the writing. He's not a very clear cut character. I mean, if before the Solo film came out, I had no idea how they would approach Solo because he doesn't really have any real fixed. You know, in the first one, he's a bit of a cowboy, a bit of a cheeky cowboy. But in the second one, he's a sort of a very antagonistic romantic. And I say romantic in a sort of very broad terms. But, you know, the character's given a sort of romantic edge. And in the third one, he's a bit of a fool. He's a bit of a joke character who sort of bumbles around, knocking into things and sort of looking awkward. It's just like a subpar Indiana Jones almost. And then in the Solo film, again, he's perhaps a little more like he is in, well, he's just sort of an embodiment of all three of those. So Solo, I find difficult because the definitiveness is kind of Ford, but then when he comes back in The Force Awakens, he kind of feels like Harrison Ford to me rather than Solo. And it's like, you know, what is Solo? Is it just what we see of Harrison Ford, which is, you know, this kind of archetypal, sort of working class, rugged hero, or actor who plays in that sort of way, these rugged heroes. But I don't know. And so with Wolverine, I mean, I certainly can't imagine anyone doing. I tell you one which is interesting, which goes away from film but into television in terms of definitive, is Siegfried Farnan from All Creatures Great and Small. Robert Hardy's is kind of so definitive when they make the new series. Siegfried is based more on Robert Hardy than he is on the books, and I think that's an interesting situation. There's no doubt. I mean, not just in the way that he's played, but also in the fact that the actor's 50, which was pretty much what Robert Hardy was when he should be a 28-year-old, as he is in the books. So again, it's interesting how the definitiveness of Hardy is replicated, and replicated. And then, to be fair, I really like the new Siegfried. I like the new characterization. I think he works. I don't think he is a carbon copy of Hardy. But certainly a lot of it is based on, as you say, the perception of Siegfried, probably by the writers and by the actor and by the casters that Robert Hardy is a definitive Siegfried, not the Siegfried from the book, who was a young man, young eccentric vet.
Yeah. Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? How I mean, it's not unique to this either, because you know, over the years, have been stage portrayals that have been borrowed from previous stage portrayals, usually in Shakespeare, but not limited to Shakespeare. The Robert Hardy thing. I mean, Samuel West seems to be more. We're getting off the point here entirely, but I find he's more defined as an actor these days, as he was maybe 20 years, 30 years ago, when he was a younger actor. As he's aged, he's got a lot better to me, or more compelling, perhaps is the word I'm looking for. I always enjoy watching him now. He turned up in a Midsummer Murders if year ago or so, and he was very good in that as well.
But yeah, it is interesting, the question of definitiveness, and as you say, with the return of Logan, that, like you say, is a curious situation, both in terms of narrative, which they sort of address in their second video, glibly, but also just as you say, in the sense of, I mean, for me, in a terms of political sense, in terms of entertainment, that I have no doubt that Disney will want to eventually, in a few years' time, push towards a sort of mutant saga and the X-Men. And I have no doubt they will not want to have Hugh Jackman, because Hugh Jackman will be obviously a few years older and he's already moving into middle age nicely. They'll want to recast. So again, that's kind of interesting, is into sort of the sort of acceptance of having Hugh Jackman come back after they have got the rights back to X-Men from Fox. So they don't, so it is their property to do as they wish. So they do not need to have Hugh Jackman back, who is associated to the older franchise, which to some degree they will want to distance from to create their new product, their new franchise product. And yet they've had him come back. That's a kind of interesting issue of sort of like star capital there, maybe.
Well, I'm not convinced they actually need to distance themselves from it. They could, there's nothing that has happened that contradicts anything that happened in the first two movies, at least. I'm not sure about that.
But there's also the fact that I'm talking more about distancing it from a franchise which is not, in the last 15 years, done horrendously well in the box office. I think they will want to kickstart the X-Men as part of their franchise with a fresh sense of values and identity, which does not link back to the Phoenix, Dark Phoenix film or Age of Apocalypse film.
Yeah.
I think that is why I think they will distance from it. It's like, we want to, as these companies always do. You know, they want to create their own vision, you know, as we've seen with their, I mean, obviously they've broken this trend. And I think the reason why they've done this, in part, and we say the reason they've done this, because I think to some degree, again, there's a certain political capital that Reynolds will have. And if Reynolds wants to do this, I think they're going to be more malleable than if some unknown sort of suggested, I think it'd be good to have Hugh Jackman back.
Yeah.
But I think the reason they are doing this is No Way Home. I think No Way Home was such a success in revisiting actors and franchises that do not belong to Disney, that are in a sense to some degree competitors. Sony is to some degree a competitor, and to re-energize that in a way which has worked very positive for Disney. I think that is why they're very comfortable with having Jackman come back, and like with Tobey Maguire or Garfield, they don't ever have to reappear again. And they've still got their Tom Holland. So I think that's part of the parcel of this. But I think, again, it's just very interesting. And I think, as you say, politically it's interesting because, again, you're reinforcing Jackman as Wolverine for even longer.
Yeah.
It's going to make it a lot harder to bring in a new Wolverine when there's going to be a lot of resistance to that.
Yeah, I was going to come to that, so you've done that for me. Do you know what, though? Because we've accidentally stumbled here across a mirror. I mean, obviously we're talking about the definitive thing, and we mentioned Tom Baker, or maybe William Hartnell, or maybe David Tennant, or whatever, whoever you think it might be, John Pertwee, whomever. But coming back to David Tennant, we have David Tennant coming back to Doctor Who is a complete surprise. And then from our angle of this being recorded in late September 2022, at this point, it looks like a strange thing to do when you have also cast the new Doctor, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you've got Tennant casting at Shadow.
I think in the end, I think it's about looking at how there is a shift, I suspect, and there could be something good to be written on this, actually. There's something in how I wonder whether the show is moving away from the notion of it being a sort of centrally character run. Because, I mean, the show is called Doctor Who, which obviously responds to the central character, the Doctor. And the focus of the show and its direction in terms of narrative and in terms of production has always been around that character. You know, it's about who is the next Doctor Who. Oh, it's going to be David Tennant, Peter Capaldi. And I wonder whether it's a move away to Doctor Who being about more of a universe, in the sense that they are now, where there's now so many doctors, why hinder your ability to tell stories by being stuck on this singular rail that is dictated by this one doctor? Why not let it be not an ensemble, but far more open to the fact that it's not like almost like a Coronation Street, you know, you can say who you think the main characters are, but there are always other characters on the street. So if you've got a whole load of doctors, why make the show so much about one central actor or actress, or let's just call them actor, when you've got all these other threads to pull on? And that doesn't take away from that lead actor. So I think, I wonder whether there's a sort of shift in how the show considers the importance or how much the show pivots around one actor, and about saying, well, yeah, it'll still be about that one actor, but we can bring all these other, because it's Doctor Who. They're not the Doctor, because David Tennant's the Doctor as well, and Peter Capaldi's the Doctor as well, and Paul McGann is the Doctor as well. So why should it be so associated with one singular current actor? And, you know, does that limit us to be able to just play with this? And I think that's what this is. I think it's about playing with that and going, yeah, this is the age we're now in. This is the age where audiences are wanting that, into a point where they're expecting that. And if they don't get it, sometimes they're kind of disappointed. Sony and your vampire film, you know, that was one of your bad luck, is you came off the back of No Way Home. And everyone was like, we love this. We want to see Andrew Garfield again. Oh, a film which would technically be set in Andrew Garfield's universe or Tobey Maguire's, but neither of them are there. That's interesting. And that's the problem.
Yeah, I'd never really considered that particular aspect of either of those things you just referred to. I wonder, then, there is obviously a kind of an audience for what you've just described, but I don't know, I'm not 100% convinced, I've got to admit.
An audience for what?
For a world where there's lots of Doctor Who's, basically.
I don't think it's a world where, like I said, I don't think it's going to be something where it's done all the time. But I think it's something where it will open up more to being done. Like I think I've said before, and again, this is just pure speculation. I think, as Davis has said, he's quite comfortable with the Timeless Child. He likes that. I think that, as I've said before, that will open up to Nth Doctors, that he can do a single show based, you know, as I say, with Hugh Jackman as the Doctor, with a police box, and it can just sit anywhere in that timeline. It doesn't matter. And you just have your own single, you know, event spectacle thing that doesn't get in the way of Shooty, whoever's playing the Doctor, and it will exist. And I think that's kind of where they want to be. And it kind of makes sense because of Big Finish, as well as the main show, these doctors are all co-current. You know, Davison, McCoy, Baker, McGann, Tennant, obviously, before obviously coming on TV again, Eccleston, you know, they're all still current. They're still Doctor Who. And it kind of makes...
He's passed away, but there's still new ones coming out that he's recorded.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I'm sure eventually Smith will dip his toe back in the pool, and I'm sure eventually Capaldi will, and I'm sure Jody will too. So there is a common sense in perhaps opening it out, and I think it'd just be interesting to see how they do it, and as you say, because it is unusual, and there is that kind of weird thing going on. Well, but Shooty is the doctor now, but then it's like, well, maybe this is the time for that to change, especially when you've got so many people who have, as you say, their definitive doctor. Why should you make it that they have to just suck it up and always, you know, from here on, it's always going to be this guy? It's like, well, no, maybe another doctor will drop back. Maybe that'll be fun. Maybe we could do a standalone story with one of the doctors and it won't interrupt. Maybe, you know, Shooty still gets his money. I don't know. It's, yeah, but it's interesting. And I think it all comes down to, as I say, what is definitive? And Tennant, to a lot of people, is as definitive as any current doctor.
Yeah,
but then, as you say, Doctor Who's been doing that longer than most shows, acknowledging the definitiveness of John Pertwee, William Hartnell, and Patrick Troughton. You know, back in the '70s.
Yeah, I wonder then, what are we doing in our heads when we watch something, when we then, because you can't just be purely about the actor, because Superman 3 and Superman 4 are terrible compared with Superman the movie and Superman 2. So what is happening when we're watching something to make an audience? Because no one's wandering around even remembering that Dean Cain was Superman. Never mind even considering him to be, well, maybe there's some lunatic Dean Cain fan. But, you know, no one's saying that he's the definitive, no one's saying he's saying he's the definitive Superman. Whereas you could quite effortlessly level that status on Reeves. So what is happening with a viewer when they're watching something that makes something definitive?
Well, I suppose it's the same with Han Solo being the definitive Solo, despite the fact that, you know, Force Awakens wasn't great. Return of the Jedi, let's face it, was not brilliant either. You know, you pick and choose to a degree what you are thinking about when you think about definitive.
Okay.
I guess that's really, I mean, to me, Christopher Reeve is not the definitive Superman. He was a definitive Clark Kent.
No, that's an absolutely fair point. I know exactly what you mean.
And I'm not disputing. I know you probably feel that as well. I mean, is Superman sort of, to me, always looked the part, definitely. But to me, no other Superman has ever really been able to work out how to play out the Clark Kent persona with Superman. And I think that, to a degree, is a little bit to where the comics evolved, and where the characters became fairly interchangeable. But yeah, to me, that's why Reeves always does it, regardless of the films. And I don't think any of the films were perfect, any of his films. I mean, Superman 2 was, to me, the best. Superman, the original film, is a bit drawn out. Lex is very silly in that. Hackman plays him up so much that it does take away some of the sense of belief in that world. But yeah, his portrayal was just very, very strong. And I think Superman's one of those characters which is just hard to make definitive. But then, you know, maybe, I mean, look at Wonder Woman. I mean, a lot of people said Linda Carter was, you know, the definitive Wonder Woman. And, you know, is she now? I'm not sure.
I think that's probably a generational thing, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, I watched it as a little kid, and I've watched the recent ones. And I've got to say, I think the recent ones are far better. And that's not Linda Carter's fault, no. Obviously. Again, that's the other factor here, is that, you know, where do you separate, and this is kind of what you were alluding to, where do you separate the ensemble of the production from the singularity of thinking of the character?
Is it also possibly because in this particular case that there've been so few Wonder Womans?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's certainly true. And I think possibly Wonder Woman probably has less of a cultural memory in terms of what Wonder Woman's like to sort of compare it to, while there are sort of, again, these assumptions of what Superman is that the cultural memory has does not necessarily mean it's accurate to what's on the page. But Sherlock's another one, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Who is the definitive Sherlock? And there's lots of cases there for various ones from different people.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, that, isn't it? And I suppose that becomes tricky because there have been so many different interpretations of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if you include, you know, people like House, who is close enough on the fringe of being sued, if that was possible. But, you know, it's, yeah, it's a versatile, it's been made into a versatile character. But yeah, I think a lot of the time it is down to familiarity, isn't it? You know, definitiveness often comes down to familiarity, which Doctor Who lacks, because that familiarity is forced changed, you know, every 3 to 4 years. So you don't have that sort of locked in idea of what you see as a character as to being the definitive thing to what is told as a story.
Well, character in the story. 3 to 4 years, except in the case of the one person that could arguably be called definitive, who isn't David Tennant, but Tom Baker, because he had the 7 years, doesn't he? So he has that huge footprint on being absolutely. Doctor Who.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I think Tom Baker's a difficult one, isn't it? Because I think it's the time period helped to some degree, but I think also he took the role in a way that just kind of worked for its period, that was just so distant from what Pertwee had done, and then so well embraced, and probably also with the merchandise and the way it sort of expanded, maybe that's also a factor.
Well, I was going to say also, not just that, essentially he's three Doctor Who's as well in some ways, because he has three producers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's not a consistency there.
So it's not that it's inconsistent, is it? It's more that it evolves in surprising ways between each block.
But then you'd also perhaps argue that the definitive Tom Baker is probably actually not the John Nathan Turner Tom Baker in people's heads.
No.
I think there is, to some degree, it's a blur of, I don't know, to be honest.
Well, I suspect Tom Baker in Tom Baker's head is probably closer to the curator than any of the others.
Yeah. Yeah, quite probably. But it's an interesting thing is, you know, what is the, you know, if people watch, people who think of Tom Baker as a doctor and you showed them, say, three episodes, which episode links closest to what they see as their definitive Tom Baker doctor?
Ooh, that's tricky. Is this a challenge for now?
It can be.
Well, do you know what? I would, although I like the broodingness of Pyramid of Mars and the Seeds of Doom, I would probably more towards sort of Pirate Planet and City of Death sort of stories. They're both Douglas Adams, aren't they?
Well, this is the point, you know, is that key to the definitiveness? I mean, I was sort of settling oddly, and I didn't expect myself to do this, on Androids of Tara.
Right.
And I don't know why, but I suppose, for me, Robots of Death, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know, have you noticed something? We've both initially gone with sort of later era, sort of middle to late era Tom Baker.
Mm.
And Kavanagh will be listening to us. And he'll be, you know, he'll be shouting his favourite episode title at the podcast.
Yeah, I know.
We've intentionally avoided mentioning, but also we're kind of in the same ballpark anyway, which is very, very confusing. Because, you know, I would, you know, it depends on the mood as well. I mean, right now I'm feeling frivolous, so I probably would go for Douglas Adams or the era when Douglas Adams is script editing. But equally, if it was later on today, I'm a bit tired, I might prefer, you know, Pyramid of Mars, Robots of Death, Seeds of Doom, you know, any of those. So there's a mood to it as well, I suppose.
Well, I'd personally say ones like Horns of Nymon, just to throw an episode out there. I would say that's not my doctor, because I think that's too Tom Baker for me.
Too Tom Baker.
I think it gets to a point there where it just becomes a little, almost like an actor doing a very good send up of Tom Baker, of the Doctor. Tom Baker sending up the Doctor or parodying him.
It is. It's the old the Tom Baker show by that point, isn't it? So
yeah, absolutely. So I mean, while I respect people who adore that, and that's great, I think for me a little bit earlier, but not too early. I think when it's too early, he's a little too reserved to be in the Tom Baker. He's a little more, I mean, he's great in Ark in Space, but he's still quite a withdrawn character in that. And like, and in Revenge of the Cybermen, where he spends most of the first episode standing in the background, watching everything happening until the last 2 minutes going, actually, it's the Cybermen, you know, having watched the cyber ship come into area and then cyber ship come to dock, you know, he just stands there. Just like, you know, that Doctor wouldn't be doing that two seasons on. But yeah, so I think it is interesting about, you know, what is Quinn. And the same with McCoy, isn't it? When people think of McCoy as being the quintessential Doctor, they're not thinking of the first season.
No, no, almost certainly not. Unless they have a very clear image of him hanging from his umbrella off a crevice.
Yeah.
In which case that would colour their entire take on that Doctor, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
For good or bad. Yeah, I suppose. Well, I'll tell you what, because it's kind of slightly topical and because I can link to it in the show notes along with everything else that I can find a link to that we've talked about. We mentioned Bond and we mentioned Connery. I'm imagining you were alluding to Brosnan, but you might have been alluding to Moore or even Dalton. But the reason I mention this is Pierce Brosnan was interviewed in GQ magazine recently, and there's a video of it in which he sits there like this because he is a very sort of cultured actor, describing all of his favourite style fashion possessions, his sunglasses and his watch. And I probably turned it off after that because I was feeling a little bit unwell by the whole thing. But you know, he is in many ways Bond, and with recent news, I can link to Gaming Retro. Cool. Concerning the old GoldenEye 007 game on the Nintendo 64, which is being re-released for the Nintendo Switch and on Xbox Live sometime later this year, he's kind of Bond again in some ways, which is very... That in itself is quite an unusual thing, because you know, you wouldn't get... I don't think you would... I mean, even with... I mean, there's obviously a re-release aspect to this, and I don't know what... I don't imagine Harrison Ford has voiced Han Solo in anything outside of Star Wars. I'm not sure about Hugh Jackman with this Wolverine games. Tom Baker's voice has appeared in Doctor Who games. But that takes things into a completely new dimension, doesn't it? Because you're getting like this portrayal that shaped a key genre in the video gaming industry, then being re-released in a kind of semi-free sort of subscription sort of a way on current game consoles. And that sort of brings the whole Brosnan Bond back at a very good point when there isn't actually a Bond to go at the cinema and watch anymore. And that arguably gives him a very big Bond footprint. Almost, I mean, if you went for the first Bond movie to last movie, you've got Connery with 1962 and 1983. I'm not including The Rock. And then you've got Brosnan with 1995. And then a video game release of the 1995 game movie, which was released in 1997, the video game, now coming out in 2022, 25 years later. He's arguably got the biggest footprint as Bond now in terms of time.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, to be fair, Connery's footprint is in a similar way. I mean, his appearance in 83 was not continuity, but another attempted remake of Thunderball, wasn't it? So
yeah, yeah.
His footprint is again slightly artificial.
It's a strange. I mean, maybe footprint is the right way of looking at it, but
footprint's kind of interesting. Yeah,
it is, because it affects our cultural interpretation, our entire discussion, and our interpretation, our views, and our feelings about these things, doesn't it? Because it then comes back and it's there, and you refer back to it, and that's who it is. And then all of a sudden, you've got this video game, and you know, I mean, I wouldn't imagine the majority of people that listening to this podcast, or both of them, have played GoldenEye. Or if they have, it was very fleetingly, maybe walking past it in a branch of Dixon's or whatever back in the day, or Rumbelows or wherever. But it remains a hugely influential game and sold a lot of copies in those days. Mm. It's hugely influential. It's still referred to now in terms of even as a yardstick for Bond games, which haven't been great. Oh, they've been very mixed over the past two decades.
So,
yeah, so you were going to say something anyway, and I interrupted you.
Oh, I can't remember. Although, to be just as a footnote, I was actually referring to Daniel Craig, but personally speaking.
Were you really?
Yeah, I was. I was thinking more of his long footprint. And
well, yeah, he has got a big one, yeah, footprint.
But, yeah, I personally, for me, I found the Brosnans, sounds like a family, the Brosnans. The Brosnans were more engaging to me into what I saw Bond was than Daniel the Craig. I always liked Bond having this sort of almost self-aware indulgence in the sort of British sort of construct of what British is, which it isn't. And that being sort of almost sort of reinforcing the world's view, this sort of ridiculous spy genre, this very clean and proper British spy. There was just something that the Brosnan brought to that, which felt very much of the flow, which Craig kind of resisted. And that's not to say I didn't enjoy Craig's. I think some of his work was really interesting. I don't think the films particularly had enough variation in them for me to even be able to separate them out. Often they blur into one.
They do. I think you think you're right there. Yeah.
While Brosnan's to me are very distinctive and not all brilliant in themselves, but again, to me, he was very much a definitive Bond for me. But like you say, that's I still like Connery's stuff. I think Connery's stuff's great. Nothing against Connery.
Yeah, it's all fun. I do enjoy Connery's. Although there is we're talking about how Tom Baker's Doctor kind of varies in tone throughout. Connery's Bond similarly does. It goes from very kind of serious at the beginning and then gets a bit more frivolous towards the end of his time in the movies. This podcast is probably, and if it isn't, then I'll cut this bit out, called Who is the Definitive Doctor Who and Why? And it's arguable that we've actually been able to come to a definitive here. So,
well, I mean, we should try and address that, I think, given that you've foolishly titled this podcast for that. What is the definitive... and as you say, I think the question is, you know, how do you frame definitive? I mean, is definitive something which is based on numbers of that creates that sort of cultural sort of idea that this person is definitive because most people think it, or is it sort of intellectually reasoned, you know, by viewing figures or influence on other, on future versions or, I don't know.
No, it's tricky.
So I think in the end, it's about deciding on how definitive is framed before we can come to an answer, or whether frame it in like two ways. I mean, I would argue with a show like Doctor Who, you can't do it culturally unless you split it. And even then you've got a problem because you've still got 25 years, you know, you've got generations watching it, which are going to influence on who is the definitive.
Yeah.
You know, someone over 40 will probably, you know, an average person over 40 will probably go Tom Baker. An average person at 26 will probably go David Tennant.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think you're right. My nieces started watching Doctor Who. You know, the oldest one was born in 2004. The second one was born in 2005. So they were watching Doctor Who when they were sort of like 5 or 6 sort of age. And they are very much keen on Matt Smith. And I think one of them's just started watching House of the Dragon because she loved Matt Smith's Doctor so much. But when they first started watching Doctor Who, they were sat with me on a Saturday tea time after I'd made them some pizza. My wife and I didn't have children in those days, so we used to look after them a lot. And their first Doctor was David Tennant. But I do think I guess like lots of people were born sort of maybe 1970, that they were aware of John Pertwee, but Tom Baker was the Doctor that they linked into and becomes the definitive Doctor. And I suppose, and there's probably other elements to this, not just Tom Baker having been in the role for such a long time. David Tennant, I suppose, in a mirror, wasn't the Doctor for quite as long on TV, but he's come back when asked. He did the bits in Sojourn Adventures as well. So although I think Matt Smith probably has a claim, but go on.
Well, I was just thinking, if you think of definitive, it's obviously something which can only be done with hindsight. You can't do it with foresight, obviously. And that's a silly thing to say, but obviously it means that you're talking about a period of time.
Yeah.
So it's an assessment of a period of time. Now, I would argue that definitive can't be the original. Otherwise, that would mean everything else is derivative of the original.
Oh, right. Yes, very good. Yes.
So therefore, you've got an idea to start looking at what derivative means. So it's got to be something which perhaps is at a point where it is at its best by a set of values and standards which one would have to decide upon, and then is never quite captured in the same way or improved on after that, which again suggests that there is a set value of what the Doctor should be, which again we open ourselves up to a whole can of worms on that point. But it does make for an interesting argument of what could be definitive. And then if you take the whole series as we've been as one rather than two productions, that makes it complicated again as well. And I think you would have quite a strong argument maybe for someone like Matt Smith. I'm not saying that would be my definitive, but I think there are definitive values in Matt Smith. I think Matt Smith builds upon past characterizations, yet himself is something which hasn't been done before. Tennant equally has some of that, but I would argue Tennant is quite a callback to a lot of Tom Baker, Davison, and maybe a little McCoy in there, which Matt Smith isn't. Now, that's not to say I prefer Matt Smith, but I'm just thinking on these sort of values.
Yeah.
I mean, but then you could sort of say, you know, Christopher Eccleston brought some values and engagements which hadn't been done before.
Well, Eccleston brought something completely new, arguably, because...
But you know, that is the problem. Does that make him definitive? Is he really building on what was done before? Is he bringing something too much new that he's no longer really... he's not, as a character, really attached to that legacy? And that's not his fault, but that's where his story was.
Yeah.
So I would say Eccleston isn't a definitive Doctor, even though I think he's a very good Doctor in terms of these definitions of what definitive is. Again, I mean, I enjoyed Capaldi, but I don't think they had enough handle on who that Doctor was to be able to call him definitive. There were multiple iterations there.
Yeah, there's a lot of Pertwee and Baker in there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And deliberately too. So you've got, and again, is Jodie too much of a break from traditional way? I mean, there's a lot of Davison in Jodie, I think, but is it too much of a break to sort of say definitive? Is it too much of a cultural handbrake turn? You know, for a lot of people, it's like, wow, we've never considered having a different gender as a Doctor. Is that just too big a thing that to say that's definitive, or something that is a characteristic which we built into future Doctors to another definitive, where she becomes part of the building blocks, which I would say is probably more likely. Again, we're just spitballing this. I never talked about this before, so I'm sure there's many holes in the arguments I'm making here. Again, McCoy, you could sort of say, is he definitive? And I'd say, well, in some ways, yeah, and in some ways, no. In some ways, no. There was a split in the personality of the character, which means it's hard to sort of say what McCoy was. But equally, while there is a lot of building, sort of intellectual building in that character, of sort of going, okay, this character, the second part of that character is very much a reaction to who the Doctor is. You know, it's Cartmell saying, who is Doctor Who? And so in a lot of ways, there's sort of a definitive, it's almost like a definitive answer. They've sort of got to a point where going, well, this guy goes through time, he's very old, he knows a lot, he knows all these baddies, he's very smart. He's going to get to a point where he can manipulate things. He can manipulate. he can become controller of all those aspects because we've seen him do all these things in the past. So he almost becomes, at that point, an answer to all those previous iterations, you know, that have basically led to this idea of McCoy, who is a bit of Troughton. There's a bit of little bit of Baker in there, sometimes a little bit of Hartnell, you know, but yeah, his whole position is reactive. So I wouldn't say he's definitive. He's almost like an answer.
And we are kind of doing Mr. Troughton a disservice as well by not actually mentioning him at this point, but a lot of
Troughton.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, Troughton, I would say, is one of, like Hartnell, is one of the building blocks. He's vital to the growth of the character. Absolutely vital. You know, you look at him, you look at Davison, you look at McCoy, you look at Tennant, you look at Smith, and, you know, to some degree, even Baker, you know, are predominantly answers to Troughton, because Troughton is the real first eccentric. John Pertwee's eccentricity is there, but it's very much in a sort of almost Bondian Avengers sort of, a Steed sort of way. But
yeah,
they all speak to Troughton. So he's one of the building blocks, but I don't think that makes him definitive.
Okay.
Because I don't think it goes downhill after him. I think they build on that success.
So are we then saying that Tom Baker is the definitive Doctor Who?
Well,
based on that approach.
You could, I would say that, yes, to some degree, you'd probably have to argue either. I would probably argue either Tom Baker, for one set of reasons, or as I've argued, Matt Smith possibly for another. And I can't say they're my favourites. I find the problem with Tom Baker, the reason I would top Smith over Baker, which I think is extremely dangerous in terms of responses to this, is that Baker's Doctor is not consistent, and it's not even like it's a shift in his experiences changing him, like say with Tennant. He's inconsistently written. He's written differently under different productions. And by the end, the way he's playing it to the way they're writing it is a lot to do with the political tensions as it is about the character.
Yeah.
So I would sort of say, yeah, he's again more than massive. I would say he's like a God tier building block like Troughton, if not more so. Well, more so than Troughton. But then you've got to say, well, Smith was actually kind of fluid. He starts off as a young character, and the character kind of ages with the character consistently, with the actor. And at the end, the last season of Smith is very different to the first season of Smith, but feels very much where that character's meant to be. You know, he's gone through the loss of Pond. That changes him. Yeah. It's all very consistent. So you could perhaps argue a definitive Doctor is Matt Smith, because he is fully fleshed out, consistent. Might not be your favorite Doctor, and he's a very strong accumulation of all the stuff that's gone before. He can be manipulative like McCoy. He can be very gentle like Davison. He can be very fast speaking, very, very eccentric like Baker, and very fast moving and excited like Troughton. You know, he's a little bit of gruffness of Baker occasionally. These aren't intentionally there. It's not like he's just having to pick from all of them, but he feels like a response to all those characters to create this definitive Doctor. I don't know. I'm spitballing. I'm just trying to make us make the hour.
I think that we have probably, we've taken this as far as we can, so we need to hand it over to our listeners. So if you get in touch with us on Facebook or on Twitter or email editor@castderbris.co.uk, yeah, new email address, or podcastderbris@gmail.com, and let us know what you think. Or if you have my phone number, you can text me as well. You know who you are. We will be back for another show soon. Until then, it's goodbye from us.
Goodbye. It's good, isn't it?